You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we hope to be talking very shortly with Mick Lowe. Mick Lowe worked at the Globe and Mail for many years, and he was a columnist at I believe it was in Northern Miner. I'm going to make sure we get that right. In Sudbury, he knows Sudbury like the back of his hand. He is the author of the Nickel Range Trilogy, and it has now he's completed the second novel, The Insatiable Maw, and it is on shelves and in your library. You should order it. It's full of, as I say, very pertinent information for people who want to understand the function of the nickel mining for Ontario, for Canada, and all the political ramifications. And we spoke to him about the first novel, and it had to do with that period in history where the miners, well, actually, mine mill and smelter workers union was in a struggle with steel, and Mick covered that beautifully in the novel. I think we're talking to Mick Lowe. Are you there, Mick?
I'm right here, Phil.
Hey, it's good to talk to you, Mick. You got yourself a handsome new book. By the way, let's give some credit to the illustration on the cover. Who did that?
Same guy as the first one, Oris Sawchuk, local Sudbury architect, artist, designer, man about town, last of the old line ladies' men.
Yeah.
As I like to call him.
Yeah.
Yeah, great guy.
Well, it's a perfect cover for the book. Mick, you took us in the first novel. You took us into what the experience. You began with the dive into a mine, which was harrowing, and you captured that wonderfully. And you took us the life of a mine mill worker, and who got involved with the struggle with steel. Now that same individual, who got terribly injured in the first volume, found himself a new job. And what do you know? Now you're introducing us to the furnace and the milling part of
the smelting. That's right.
The
melting,
the smelting plant. It makes a good transition. Of course, he has to make the. He's got to be. He's still in this problem of. He's got a kind of mine mill state of mind, and now he's with the steel workers, and now he's in a wholly new job. Your description of the working the smeltering process, I have to say it's hard to choose between which is the rougher, mining or in a smelter plant. Like those conditions were terrific. Did you yourself ever go into those? I mean, you have your writer in the book. He does it.
Yeah. Well, I certainly was in the smelter back in the bad old days. Yes.
You yourself were able to go in and get a first-hand view.
Yes, I was. I was part of various tours, groups of people who were escorted through the smelter.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the Globe thinks of your writer going without a sneaking into the plant.
Trespassing is the word, I think. Well, it did happen to me once, in fairness to the Globe. The account of what happened to the character Foley Gilpin is based on an experience I had in Timmins at the Kidd Smelter Complex, where I sneaked in, I got caught, and taken right away, whisked to the security guard's headquarters, and the guy said, just a minute, and he got my managing editor on the line, my city editor at the Globe, the Ontario editor, and he said, I've got a guy sitting here who claims he writes for you. His name is Mick Lowe. Is he with you for real? And my, to the everlasting credit of my boss, he said, yeah, he's there up there. I sent him in there. He's there on my orders. And so that was that. They let me go with a caution.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, listen, by the way, I mean, let's pay some tribute to the Globe. You were an excellent journalist for the Globe, your coverage of all the events there. Frankly, the Canadian public was benefiting from the coverage. It was a very solid work.
Well, thank you. I'd like to think that's the case.
We credit them. At one point, your journalist, you discussed this matter, but you might elaborate on it. The Globe Style business said, firsthand is not good enough. You're going to have to find solid witnesses. That idea is as old as the Bible. You got to have three witnesses. Seems to me good policy. They don't like the I, right? You have to be a we writer.
Oh, there is definitely no I. No first-person reportage. Yeah. That is just not on at the Globe and Mail or the Star or most news outlets.
Yeah, we're speaking to Mick Lowe. The book is The Insatiable Maw, a line you got from a very prominent and colorful figure in Sudbury.
Right. Sudbury lawyer, politician, orator, a man about town. His name was the late Elmer Sofa. Mm-hmm. He used this phrase in a newspaper column that I read about the Coppercliff smelter, and it stuck with me and never left. And he wrote about the fact that the average miner, all the miners and the mines of Sudbury exist for one singular purpose, which is to feed the insatiable maw of the Coppercliff smelter.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just a marvelous turn of phrase, and I started out the book using that in the first section as a heading, and it's one, and then a chapter, and then a section heading, and then I thought, wow, what the heck? It's so good. It's just taken over here. It should be the title of the book.
Yeah.
You know, the way that these things sometimes do, and some of the characters do too. You think you've got a little spear holder there, a placeholder that you've invented, sort of a throwaway guy like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in Hamlet, and they just won't stay down. They just keep popping up and taking up more and more air in the narrative. It's the damnedest thing when you're telling fiction, and fun, too, when that happens. You're trying to beat them back and beat them back, and yet they're in there. They got a voice and a brain, and they're whispering at you. It's funny.
Yeah. Again, it's Mick Lowe, and the book is Insatiable Maw. Now, this is Volume 2 of the Nickel Range Trilogy, and you have me looking forward to the third volume. Let's all pray that you're hard at work on that.
I am hard at work, but it's taking longer than I had hoped. It's going to be a bigger book than these first two, because just as this here, the Insatiable Maw, Volume 2 there, is the retelling of a factual story in fiction, so the third one will be the fictional retelling of the legendary 1978-9 strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big story. That was a titanic battle between labor and capital, one for the books, one for the ages, and Canadian, all of labor and Canadian labor history, the longest ever in terms of person days lost to a labor dispute in the entire history of Canada.
Yeah, and in a crucial industry, as you pointed out in the first volume, that this has fed the U.S. military machine, requires nickel, and that it had ramifications all over, and it had great battles all the way to the state of New Mexico, of course, mine mill and steel and others, with the nickel bosses. This is, again, it's Mick Lowe. Mick, you picked out a symbol, too. Sudbury has, as you derisively remark about the nickel itself that sits on the edge of town. But it could be better knowing. Maybe you ought to put a big lunch bucket up there.
Yeah, that would be more apt, I think.
Who created that lunch bucket?
That's a local family. Their last name is May. And it was a father, the patriarch, had worked at Inco and developed the idea of this stainless steel lunchbox that could withstand the rigors of the workplace. And so he invented it, brought it to production, and he's since, I believe, passed away. And his daughters have taken it over and are running a very successful business at it.
Yeah. Well, it's almost a collectible. You'd think somebody start putting out mini lunchboxes, when people visit one place or another in Sudbury, because it has a legendary quality. So many of these people, the working people there, men and women, put things on those lunchboxes to remember things, the campaigns, strikes, favorite candidates, the whole thing.
That's right. You put on stickers or decals and showing who you supported in the last local union election, who you supported between Mon Mill and Steel. It's all on your lunchbox. You can tell at a glance. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that has, even here, is devalued. You know, the working history, the union history, the workers' history, the people's history is just not, you know, something that the Chamber of Commerce or the wealthy, the people who design the museums, much value, much appreciate. They don't stress it, and of course that's a shame. So it falls into desuetude, and so the kids never learn it in school, and then eventually people begin to forget it, naturally. They forget these things ever happened at all. And that's one reason I think it's so important to tell the stories.
Yeah. Actually, if it wasn't for people like Jack London and Upton Sinclair and yourself, we wouldn't know these things. There was a genre, a very proud one, used to be called the proletarian novel. And seems to me your book actually belongs in that category. It actually tells you singing the song of the unsung. There's so many names in here that people ought to know. People who led battles and lost their lives and their families were put under all kinds of stress, who just hung by their principle, the right to organize and the right to choose their political representatives, the whole story.
Well, gee, Phil, I'm just going to sit here and listen to you use my name in the same sentence with Jack London and Upton Sinclair here for the next while. You go on talking.
Yeah.
I'll just sit and listen.
Well, I think that's true, though. And, Mick, look, let's talk about the horrors a worker face. There's a moment in the story where all of these guys in the smelter are excited because this journalist has gotten himself in the door, and he's deciding what he's going to write about and what he needs to see. And everybody's talking at once, and then somebody finally says, "No, wait, the sintering plant. He's got to go to the sinter plant." Why is that? Why did they hit on that one? What's there?
Yes, and we never did actually flesh that out. That, as we did not know at the time, but learned later, like 10, 20 years later, was a ground zero for carcinogens. And people who'd worked there for even a few months and later contracted cancer qualified for workers' comp on that basis. Not without a fight, I might add. They had to prove their case, of course. But the sintering plant was notorious for bad dust, nickel dust. And nickel, elemental nickel, is a carcinogen. We know that now. And, of course, that's what this place is about, nothing if not to create the world's purest nickel, you know, in elemental form, and that is cancer causing, that element. And of course, when you have it in a dust, and you're breathing it in your nose and your lungs,
and they had primitive ways of
things happen.
Yeah. Primitive ways of trying to protect themselves. I knew a man worked in the sintering plant at Port Colborne, and he died of cancer, of course, in the nostrils. And he said, "I have that devil in my nose," he said. And when he talked about how they tried to protect themselves, it was just pathetic, right? Handkerchiefs dipped in milk and all kinds of odd things.
Yeah, very primitive, yeah.
And of course, by the way, you've had so many fights in Sudbury that still go on there, because now you have the survivors and the problem with the survivor getting the money that they had been receiving when the employee had been alive, was it Mr. Gagnon? Is it John Gagnon?
That's right, Johnny Gagnon.
Yeah.
He's the one who blew the whistle on the sintering plant, which is closed now, by the way. I'm happy to report.
Yeah.
But I just had a call, sadly, just last week from a psychologist who does therapy with injured workers and their families, and he says that the WSIB, which is the Workers' Safety Insurance Board, is just rejecting every single claim these days and causing a tremendous amount of hardship. As he put it, they're destroying many of my people, mm-hmm. quote. And he's at his wit's end, feels now that he must go public, and a group of other psychologists are joining in with him, too, to expose what they regard as a new policy there of no, 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 claim denied, and no feedback to the professionals, and no medical records being scrutinized before these decisions are made. So it's a really, really hinky deal here.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that really points out why people got to get your book. I hope that you find a way to work these matters into the third volume. But by the way, this is Mick Lowe. The book is Insatiable Maw, the Nickel Range Trilogy. And Mick, the latter part of the book has some terrific information that I don't think most people have really digested. You bring it down nicely. Here we had a fight of people in the smelter to just try and breathe and to be able to lead a life that's not going to be cut short. And they and their union go to war over this. And then you have the people of the town who realize that the sulfur is getting into their lives and threat to them. And it goes all the way from that battle to the end of Acid Rain. Could you do that quickly?
Yeah, and that's great. And
you can throw in Margaret Atwood if you like.
It began with the safety and health battle in a workplace in the Coppercliff smelter with these activists and the United Steelworkers, Local 6500, leading the charge. And then it spread into the media and into the political realm at Queen's Park. And from there, it carried over to other media. It became a national story. And it reached a tipping point. What had begun as the workers' battle in the workplace became gradually a community-wide fight in Sudbury, with the populace here drawing lines saying, no, that's enough. We're not breathing any more sulfur. It's just killing our gardens. It's just not right, and we support those guys in the smelter, what they're trying to do. We get it.
One struggle.
Yeah, and ultimately, the Ontario government was forced to take action, really blackmailed, and I explained this in the book too, how they were blackmailed and why they were blackmailed. And I actually quote from the document that literally triggered this.
Yes. How about that Globe? Did you mock up that Globe story, or is that the actual story?
No, that's what happened. It's the way the story has been told and retold by people who went through it. And
we need to tell it some more, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I would love to have a movie made of this.
Absolutely. If we had a movie industry, it would have been already buying your book. But we have to tell them to suck up some courage and make a Canadian film.
Yeah, we need to get this down to Oliver Stone, I think, Phil.
All right. I'll call him. Give me 30 minutes. This is Mick Lowe, and it is true. Margaret Atwood congratulated everyone on that. And she said, you've got to look at Sudbury now. But she didn't, I don't know if she included that you have to go back to Coppercliff.
No, she didn't mention that, but she said she goes all over the world, of course, talking about the environment. And she comes here once a year for her birthday. So she's seen the changes here, and there are many changes to the environment since it's been cleaned up and re-greened. All kinds of awards have been given to Sudbury for its efforts in revegetation, which all started with a big stack going up and less sulfur in the local environment, but now it goes up into the jet stream, and then it's still going up there, though, but they're working on that to bring that way down. They're reducing the amount of gas that goes up the stack, which is, of course, the ultimate solution. And Reagan and Mulroney did one thing right, at least, and that was they signed bilateral agreements on reducing sulfur dioxide emissions, which caused acid rain. And it worked. And they engineered the problem out of the environment, and acid rain is no longer a threat.
Yeah. Isn't that great? And that's all because of terrific people, like one of your sources, Norris Valiquette, and others said, we want to, we have a right to live like human beings. We have a right to have conditions that that are good for our families.
And well, Margaret Atwood says, you know, if they can do it in Sudbury, they can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's true, and I think there's a template here for climate change. And I stress with young people who, you know, can become very fatalistic about this, mm-hmm. that seems overwhelming, you know, that the solutions can and have been found to these problems, yeah. multilateral or binational problems. This obviously goes just far beyond Canadians' borders, yeah. And here's living proof. It has happened. And Valet is now spending $1 billion plus to reduce the amount of SO2 that they put into the environment.
Yeah, yeah, but Mick, they got to have books like The Insatiable Ma, the second volume of the Nickel Range Trilogy, to know how to do this. So we're very grateful that you could talk to us, and we look forward to talking to you again about all these matters.
Good. Well, thanks, Phil. I appreciate it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Take care, man.
That's Mick Lowe. And I knew some of these guys, and I can tell you that Norris Valiquette, who was one of his sources, was a really sharp class fighter and a good union man, and I'm proud to know him. Anyway, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and thanks, Lucas and company. We'll see you next week.